From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, the royal family and the crown. You know, Queen Elizabeth and Charles and Diana and the Netflix series about them. Gary Young loathes the monarchy but loved the crown. We'll explain why later in the show. But first, Black History, banned in Florida. Robin Kelly will comment. He's one of the historians whose work has been targeted by Ron DeSantis.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
It's the middle of Black History Month, and we're still grappling with Ron DeSantis banning the teaching of parts of Black history in Florida public schools. Even worse, the College Board is cooperating with Florida in abandoning parts of their Black Studies Advanced Placement curriculum for high school students everywhere. At the same time, the 1619 Project, launched by the New York Times 3 years ago, proposing the transformation of the teaching of American history, is now not just a book and a podcast, it's a TV documentary, a 6-part series streaming now on Hulu. For all of that, we turn to Robin Kelly, Distinguished Professor of U.S. History at UCLA. He's the author of many books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, and Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. He's written for The New York Times, The Boston Review, and The Nation, and he was just interviewed by The New Yorker. One more thing, his work has been singled out for attack by the state of Florida. Robin Kelly, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm very proud of that fact.
Okay. Well, on February 1st, the first day of Black History Month, the College Board released its long-awaited curriculum for a new advanced placement class in African American Studies. They had removed from the course everything the Florida Department of Education targeted. One example, the Movement for Black Lives. Largest demonstrations in American history, summer of 2020. More than 20 million people participated for months everywhere in America. That was excluded as a topic of study. The targets of what Florida officials called, quote, concern, were Kimberly Crenshaw on intersectionality, Angela Davis on activism, Roderick Ferguson on Black queer studies, bell hooks on feminism, and one more, your first book, Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. So we got Kim Crenshaw, Angela Davis, Roderick Ferguson, bell hooks, and you. You're in very good company, but what do you think made these books all a target? Maybe we should start with yours, Hammer and Hoe.
Yeah, well, see, what's interesting is that none of those, well, in terms of my book and some of the other works, like Angela's work, it wasn't even included in the curriculum. That was just a red baiting move. In other words, they wanted to let the world know that I wrote a book on the Communist Party, so therefore, ergo, I'm a communist. Despite the fact that the state of Florida has had been teaching a course back from the 60s all the way up to the 1990s, I think it was, that taught Americanism versus communism. What they targeted of mine was an article called Black Study, Black Struggle, That was the one piece that was part of the original curriculum from February 2022. And what's interesting about that piece, they didn't read it because I was making a case that Black students need to read the Western canon.
Oh,
that's, you know, that you need to read everything and be critical of everything. But just step back for a minute in terms of what the College Board did versus DeSantis. Well, their argument is they made the changes independently, that they weren't pressured. And they gave all kinds of explanations why they made these changes. And these changes, as you mentioned, was the elimination, not just of Black Lives Matter, but pretty much the whole history of Black movements from the end of 1970 to the present, replaced with a discussion of Black conservatism, the great triumph of Barack Obama, the success of Black conservatives like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, and the fact that the Black middle class has succeeded. So this narrative of gradual success, and this is proof of it because of the rise of the Black middle class, replaced what was a really robust discussion of all these movements that took, when we talk about 1970, we're talking about 50 years.
Yeah.
50 years of history just kind of erased.
One step back. We're talking here about the College Board Advanced Placement course in Black Studies. What exactly is this?
So the College Board makes its money two ways, through the SAT tests and those kinds of standardized tests and through advanced placement courses. Advanced placement courses are courses for select few high school students who are college bound. And there are two things. One, you take an AP course and you supposedly get some college credit, which allows you to opt out of the course in college. That's already a bad idea. So you're basically saying that let us do an intro to African-American studies so they don't have to take our intro into African-American studies. The second thing is that the argument is that if you take more AP courses, it makes your application look better. The College Board had decided, and others have agreed, that there's so few Black students who actually take AP courses that they're trying to attract them. And one way to do it is to create a Black Studies or an African-American Studies AP course. What that means was up for debate. You know, it's always up for debate. As you know, the US history AP course is still up for debate, still struggles over that. So this is not even unique, except for the fact that what is unique is that Black studies, unlike US history, developed in a political context as a political movement. And so you can't sort of pull the politics out of it, when in fact it was contested from the very beginning. It contests almost all forms of social science and humanistic knowledge. So that's what it's for. And I think that there's an argument to be made that maybe we should be rethinking AP courses as a way to introduce and expand a kind of Black studies curriculum to public schools across the nation.
And this AP system could exist at every high school in the United States, and certainly every high school where students are bound for college teaches AP courses. And are those all kind of certified or designed by the College Board?
Well, the way it works, they create a kind of course outline, a curricular outline, and they leave it to the discretion of teachers to include secondary sources, which is to say all the articles and books. That's what they're arguing. In this initial curriculum that has been around for like a year or so, they had secondary sources. It's impossible really to teach a course that's interdisciplinary, that cuts across, you know, from literature, sociology, economics, history, and not have secondary sources. So what they did was they took out what they felt was the offending articles and material. Yes, in response to DeSantis. So they say it's not, but let's say they did.
Let's say they did.
I mean, that's the truth. But you know what? If it wasn't Florida, it could have been any state.
Yeah.
So to go back to the choices, they're saying that they're trying to keep this course in line with other AP courses, which is to say, creating a kind of database or a source of secondary sources that could draw on. But here's the most problematic aspect of this whole thing. The College Board is a 501c3 that's supposed to be a not-for-profit, but it is $1 billion a year industry. And they're about to lose money on the SAT because universities like mine and the one that you were associated with, University of California, they're eliminating SATs as admissions. So once you lose the bread and butter of SATs, all you have left in some ways are AP courses. So what does the board do? They're trying to make sure that 50 states accept these courses. And right now there are 60 pilot courses testing this new curriculum right now. And we don't even have the data on whether it's working or not working, but the College Board is claiming that the pilot courses are giving them the data to tell them that these things don't really belong. And the data is telling us that, not Florida. That's what they're saying.
Just one personal note here. Your book, Hammer and Hoe, named on the list of the Florida subjects of concern, happens to be the first book I ever reviewed for The Nation magazine, like 30 years ago. I looked up my review. I called it a fascinating and indispensable contribution to the history of American radicalism and to Black history.
You were the first reviewer to review the book in any major publication. Huh. Even the right-wing anti-communist historians have actually considered that book a legitimate book. And it's not just my book, it's all of our scholarship. In other words, we're scholars being judged by bureaucrats who work for Ron DeSantis, whose task is to politicize education. That's what they're trying to do.
So the content of the course, you've said the course that they recommend is about Black achievement, Barack Obama, Colin Powell. What is the difference between that kind of recommended Black studies course is defined by Florida and apparently the College Board and the way you and your colleagues teach Black studies?
Let me say two things about that. Even though I'm a historian, Black studies is an interdisciplinary project. I don't subscribe to the idea of teaching the true history. It's not about true history, it's about interrogation. It's constant interrogation of the structures of race, of what is it that creates the conditions of premature death and vulnerability to that and inequality. But it's also about how movements and people kind of fight back to try to make a new future, right? There's that. But the other thing is that it's also a way for students to learn how to think across disciplines. What does literature tell us about the consciousness of America or race? How do we understand gender and sexuality, for example, as a way to structure difference and inequality or even possibility and power? I mean, all these things are part of what constitutes Black studies. You know, on the other hand, just in defense of certain aspects of the curriculum, if you take the whole thing as a whole, you know, and there were a lot of really amazing people who worked on this, there's some aspects of it that I think are still very, very important and interesting in terms of a history course. They try to deal with Reconstruction. They try to deal with slavery in ways, maybe not ways I would deal with it, but any field is always fraught with debate. And difference. And if it's not, then it's not intellectual, you know? And what I think is really disturbing is the way that the Florida Department of Education would frame some of this work as historical mythology, you know, mm-hmm. Has no educational value. And educational value for people who have actually risked their lives just to teach, just to learn, you know? And then the final thing that somehow, because of the political context in which Black studies emerge, that there would be no debate, that somehow this is indoctrination. Indoctrination is when you ban books. Indoctrination is when you say that there's certain things that you're not allowed to talk about. There's no way that anyone in a classroom could talk about, say, the Black Panther Party without talking about J. Edgar Hoover in the state, without talking about, you know, you can talk about Reconstruction without understanding what are the conditions that overthrew it. What, you know, you're debating all the time. You can't talk about reparations, for example, unless we actually understand how value was extracted and who is opposed to reparations, even within Black communities. So the debate is built in. That's the point. And what Florida wants to do is eliminate debate.
The other thing Florida wants to do is emphasize the positive, make Black students feel good about their people, their history, their own lives. What do you think of that approach?
Yeah, well, that's a very old approach as well that comes from in the segment of Black studies itself. There's a long, long tradition of African-American leaderships and elites who say, you know, we don't need the trauma of having to deal with the violence and exploitation. We want to feel pride. And I understand that. It doesn't advance democracy. It doesn't advance our ability to think critically. And that's a debate. So I think that even if the state of Florida did not take that position, it would still be there, still be embedded. But it's a lot easier to discuss politically, especially within a right-wing context, the success of Black people, because it supports the myth of the American creed. And the American creed, of course, is that, you know, America was perfect from the beginning, but in all this other stuff are aberrations. So slavery was an aberration, though, and the idea is to get back to the creed. Once we get back to the creed, we're on the right track. And proof of the right track is the success of Black people. And it doesn't work that way.
Florida and other Republican states want to ban one thing in particular, the 1619 Project. Launched by the New York Times 3 years ago, shows how slavery arrived in the North American colonies before the Pilgrims, something we've known for quite a while, actually, 150 years before the American Revolution, and the ways that slavery and its legacy have shaped all of American history down to the present. It started out as a special issue of the New York Times Magazine, edited by Nicole Hannah Jones. Then it became a book, a number one bestseller for months. It's still on the bestseller list. It won a Pulitzer Prize. Then came a children's book, then a podcast. Millions of people have been reached by the 1619 Project. And now it's started a new phase, the Hulu miniseries. What did you think of Hulu's 1619 Project six-part series?
Well, in terms of the Hulu Project, I actually think it is the antidote to the College Board and to Florida and to the 42 states that passed anti-CRT laws. It is one of the best examples of what Black studies is supposed to be. And, you know, as you know, the whole point of it is to argue that slavery was not an aberration, but really foundational to the American Republic. What they end up doing, what Nicole Hannah Jones ends up doing, is taking her personal life story, her family story, and linking it beautifully with the key issues that were banned in the curriculum.
The very first episode, Democracy,
yeah.
She goes back to her childhood home and talks to a couple of her uncles about the fact that her father always had an American flag on a flagpole in his front yard. And she, being kind of one of us, is kind of puzzled and troubled by this. Why would he do this, given the history of America and Black people? What did you think of that segment?
Well, I thought it made a lot of sense, because what she was arguing was that Black people weren't simply the victims of a system that was founded on slavery and dispossession and exploitation, but rather that Black people held the potential to make America democratic. She figured out that it wasn't that he was so patriotic because he loved the country as it was. It was because he and others like him, what they were trying to do was trying to make America what they were told it was supposed to be, but they knew it wasn't. And that changes everything in terms of the narrative. So it's not the creed that's natural that eventually creates the space for success, but rather that the only reason we have democracy is because of these kinds of struggles. And that's the point, that this constant struggle of people who are dispossessed on the outside, not just Black people, immigrants, women, disabled, indigenous people, that this constant fight to expand the horizons of democracy, that's what the country's about. So you take the struggles that are taking place today and then you trace them back. That's what each episode does, but she traces them back again through her family story and through select scholars, you know, me being one of them by full disclosure, to talk about capitalism, for example. And that the episode on capitalism, or what I would call racial capitalism, is really profound in that so many of these other projects don't always deal with capitalism straight up. The fact that she's dealing with the Amazon strike in Bessemer and linking that back to how they got, what land it's on, the relationship between slave labor, the parallels between picking cotton and moving boxes. It's really quite striking. And if you don't understand why capitalism is fundamental, you will. The irony, though, is that all these states from Indiana to Florida are passing legislation that's saying capitalism must be taught. They call it free enterprise. They say we have to teach capitalism, not socialism. Well, of course, well, they're teaching capitalism. So be careful what you wish for, you know?
Be careful what you wish for. Robin Kelly is a distinguished professor of history at UCLA. You can read him most recently at thenewyorker.com, where he's interviewed by Kayenga Yamada Taylor. Robin, thanks for all your work, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, John. It's always a pleasure.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now it's time to talk about the royal family and the crown. You know, Queen Elizabeth and Charles and Diana and the Netflix series about them. For that, we turn to Gary Young. He's professor of sociology at the University of Manchester, former columnist for The Guardian, member of The Nation, editorial board, and a Type Media fellow. We reached him today at home in London. Gary, welcome back.
Thanks, John.
You are a British citizen, is that correct?
That is very true, yes.
So we need to start with the most basic of all British questions. Where were you when Princess Diana died?
That's a very good question. I was in Barbados, which is where my parents are from, on holiday. I was staying with my uncle, and he woke me up to tell me the news. We watched the news for a little bit, went back to bed. Then I went out for a walk later, and I bumped into some Brits, and I said, you know, have you heard the news? And this woman said, I know. I feel really terrible just being out on holiday enjoying myself. And I thought this was really odd. And I said to her, I'm sure if you died, Lady Di would have no problem being on holiday and going out and enjoying herself. I mean, enjoy your holiday. And she looked at me with a kind of contempt and outrage. And I thought, oh, wow, I really kind of got that wrong, you know. And I wasn't trying to be funny. And it was a realization, I don't get this. This is going to be something more, something other. And then when I occasionally would kind of pass a TV screen or check in, so I could see over the week, well, that this was a moment of national hysteria, maybe even international hysteria, and that I should keep my mouth shut.
How would you describe your engagement with the royal family? Would you call it just a lack of interest?
No, it's a very kind of, politically, I'm very clear, it's an awful institution that isn't just benign, because what it does is it puts who your parents are at the top of the British system, the head of state, which is the epitome of class privilege and deeply problematic. And that's before you get to the whole thing about empire and colonialism and what the Brits did in the name of the crown. So on a political level, it's not even a question for me. On a human engagement level, I really don't care. When the Queen died, I just didn't watch the news for 10 days. I've got nothing against her as a person. I didn't know her as a person. And that's why it didn't really interest me. Her death didn't particularly interest me any more than somebody else who died that I didn't know. When it comes to matters royal, I take the effort not to care.
Okay, you don't care about the royal family. You loathe the institution of the monarchy. How did you feel about the Netflix series, The Crown?
I loved it. Awesome. I didn't really like the last season. I found particularly weak, but the first four, I think, I really enjoyed. They acknowledge colonialism as being a significant part of Britain's recent history. Now, that may seem like a no-brainer to an American, but Britons have a peculiar way, because colonialism almost by definition happened elsewhere, of not knowing where they were or what they did.
So let's talk a little bit just about the facts of empire during the decades covered by the Netflix series. I learned from your piece in The Nation that in 1955, Winston Churchill suggested to his cabinet that the Conservative Party should run on the slogan, "Keep England White." Let's talk about that.
Yeah, you gotta love him for that. So what had happened by 1955 was the empire was striking back. The empire was coming to the mother country. My parents didn't come till 62. In the same way that if you are born in Hawaii or the Marianas Islands or whatever, you can have American citizenship, or Puerto Rico. If you were born, my parents came to Britain on a British passport. And Churchill thought that there was mileage in opposing these non-white immigrants in the 50s. So that gives you a sense of where Britain was racially at that time. But these were all British citizens.
So would you call the Netflix show a critique of empire?
No, it doesn't. It just shows that the bar is very low. Just to depict it and to give a sense of the power dynamics and how they played out is enough when you're used to it just not being dealt with at all.
Let's talk, for example, about the young queen's trip to Kenya in the early 50s.
Right. So she goes to Kenya. She's still the princess then, I think. So dad dies while she's there.
Yeah.
She arrives. She gives this talk. The young queen or the young princess talks about, Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, having been this savage place that was now civilized. They then walk the line of dignitaries, and there are some indigenous African dignitaries who Prince Philip insults. And then the local governor, I assume it's the local governor, says to her something to the effect of, look, we're really struggling to hold on here. The winds of change are blowing through this continent. So thank you for coming. And the whole scene of the welcoming band and the local dignitaries and the local kind of colonial people, notwithstanding ethnic dress, and that's all the ethnicities, including the Brits, it could have been the South mm-hmm. at the same time. It's segregated. The power relations are clear. There's perhaps a little bit more of a sense of benevolence and patronizing than you would have got in the South, but still that very parochial sense where the racial power lines are very clear.
And then there's that fascinating episode about the royal tour of 1953, where Elizabeth and Philip travel to the Commonwealth countries, and Philip says, quote, 20 years ago, Britain had influence and control over one-fifth of the world's population. Look where we are now in India, Pakistan, South Africa, Iraq, Jordan, Burma, Ceylon, all independent. And he says, we've been sent on the Commonwealth Roadshow, but it's like a rusty old banger where the rust has eaten away the engine. Quite a vivid image of what was actually happening.
Yeah. And once again, it's a depiction. It's not a critique of this sense of decline, that it's all moving away from us. You know, when in the Brexit campaign, they talked about putting the great back into Great Britain.
Yes.
There is this really crippling sense of this kind of, once great nation. And it really did happen relatively quickly. And Britain has failed to adjust. There was a great quote from, I think it was a Danish foreign minister shortly after Brexit. And he said, Europe is divided into small countries and those countries that have yet to realize that they are small. And, of course, who was he talking about primarily but Britain?
And then there was one episode that a lot of people didn't really understand. That was the one about the Russian Revolution with these vivid scenes recreating the Bolsheviks murdering the family of the Tsar. What was the point of all that?
I couldn't say for sure why they did that one. But what it did do was bring together a theme that was there right from the beginning, which is this sense of precarity. It starts with the abdication of Edward, who's the Queen's uncle, and this notion that being a member of the royal family is a choice, and he has chosen not to do it. Then you have Prince Philip, whose family were smuggled out of Greece. He says he was taken out in a crate full of oranges or something, not dignified, certainly, struggling for his life. And so throughout, there's this sense of urgency to be relevant, to keep up, to televise the Queen's coronation, to find ways to modernize this prehistoric institution.
So they don't end up like the Tsar's family.
Like the Romanovs, yeah. I mean, they are surrounded by examples of moments where it didn't go so well. And the Romanovs, you know, they are able to establish the identity of two of the Romanovs thanks to Prince Philip's DNA. And so you have to imagine, just forget their royals for a moment, and just generational trauma that you have in your family, because the Romanovs were distant relations of the Queen as well, a range of cousins, second cousins, uncles who've been killed, deposed, smuggled out, exiled, and that kind of and you're sitting on a pile of gold, and kind of everyone can see you on the top of this pile of gold, and lots of people want it. So there is this real terror would be too strong a word.
Anxiety,
a sense of fragility, yes, yeah. And anxiety.
Fragility and anxiety of the institution. Mm. So one of the main themes of the whole 5 years is that it's no fun being a royal. They are not happy. You think you'd like to be a prince or a princess? You should be glad you're not, because their lives are miserable.
Mm. This was, for me, one of the main enjoyable, really engaging aspects of this series, which was this struggle between the structural and the personal. The personal, let's say we take the Queen's sister wants to marry a man who's been divorced and she can't. And the Queen says, you know, as your sister, I want you to marry him. As your Queen, I forbid it. When Philip says, well, do I have to kneel in front of you at the coronation, which he considers demeaning? And she says, I'm not asking as your wife, I'm commanding you as your monarch. There's a moment where a village in Wales is crushed by a landslide, and all of the children in the school, particularly one class, are all killed. And the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, is beseeching her to go up. And the Queen's like, I don't want to go up there. Like, there's no point in me going up there. I'm not going to help. And he's basically saying, people need to see that you care. And she's not saying she doesn't care. She's just saying, I can't perform caring.
Mm.
She talks about coming back and having dabbed a dry eye, you know, and, you know, she kind of got away with it. And actually, that was precisely the problem that she had with Lady Diana, where it's like, I'm sorry, but you're a national symbol and we want you out here blubbing your eyes out and being really sad. And unless we see you being really sad, we're going to turn on you, because your job is not to be yourself, but to represent a nation and its mood. That's the element of The Crown that I really love, which is why I found the last season more disappointing, or just less interesting, because Charles really isn't grappling with any of that stuff. He's like, I want my mistress, I want my wife, I want to be king. And anybody who thinks that I shouldn't be having all of those three things at once is just being unfair. So he's just like a big baby, really, and that's not so interesting to watch.
Season 5, you will recall, premiered just 2 months after Elizabeth died and Charles became king. That season seemed eager to make Charles look good. There was that scene of him breakdancing during his visit to an event I learned was called Youth Meets Industry, where 300 unemployed young people were organized by a charity called the Prince's Trust. How did you like that episode?
Well, you know, I do remember that. I remember that. And I remember him being kind of keen in a kind of daddy in a paddling pool kind of way to want to identify with a country that was changing somehow. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't particularly interested because I go back to my original point. You're a toff. You're the prince. Like, you know, America, Russia, France all had the right idea. But I do remember it being more interesting than the horse riding and the polo stuff. Yes. You know, I remember my mum liked him because he liked the 3 degrees and he invited them to a gala performance. And this is a time when you didn't see many Black people on television. And these are the scraps that people eat from the table, really. So, but the truth was, for all of that, they did show him to be a kind of venal man, baby.
After the Queen died, two former prime ministers condemned the series. John Major and Tony Blair, one Tory, one Labour leader, and Judi Dench, the legendary actor, wrote a letter to the London Times describing the series as, quote, an inaccurate and hurtful account of history. She demanded that Netflix add a disclaimer to the last season, quote, for the sake of the family and a nation so recently bereaved, close quote. I wonder if you have any comment.
I mean, how crazy. I mean, it was not a documentary. I felt fairly clear that there were elements that you knew were real. The landslide in Aberfan that I just talked about, the strikes, the Falklands War. There was stuff that was real. Even if you hadn't heard of them, you could kind of spend quite a lot of time on Wikipedia after some of them thinking, did that really happen? And then there was stuff that you knew was drama, the conversations that they had and the kind of personal interactions and so on. And you thought, well, it's a drama. It's a drama based on people who actually exist, but it's a drama. And then there were a few things that could have gone either way, but I didn't really care. I mean, I don't watch Netflix for my history. You know, there are books for that. But it had landed at this particular moment when reverence was off the charts. And you know, some of Charles's life has been kind of quite embarrassing. Some of the stuff that he did that was brought up again. So yeah, the kind of elements of the ruling class kind of whipped into line to make out like, you know, this was a Seymour Hersh article that had you know, trashed a military operation or something. It was really quite odd.
Gary Young, his piece on the British royal family has the wonderful title, Heavy is the Head, The Strange Thrills of the Crown. You can read it at thenation.com. Thank you, Gary. This was great.
Thank you.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is our executive producer. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.